Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast here at peterbcollins.com. You did it. You're about to meet Cedric De Leon. He's a professor of sociology and a former union organizer. He's at Providence College. And his new book is called The Origins of Right to Work. He experienced personal pain when Michigan passed a right to work law a couple of years ago, right there in the cradle of organized labor. And Professor De Leon takes us back to the 19th century, to labor struggles in Chicago that led to the Haymarket Rebellion. And along the way, we talk about politics and Trump and the murky future of organized labor in the current climate here in the United States. All this is made possible by people like you who support my work with your subscriptions, including Joe Carson, Dick Attlee, Carla Mahoney, and Tim McKay. Thanks to each and every one of you, and if you never hear your name mentioned here, maybe you should take out a subscription, too. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and boom, you're right there where you can pick and choose the level that meets your comfort zone. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. What is the future of organized labor under a Trump administration? And even before that, we've seen states flip to right to work. It's disturbing. Walk your street, and I walk mine, and should we meet, would you spare me some time? Our opening music is called Blue Collar. It's by Bachman Turner Overdrive. Goes back to about 1980. Blue Collar. My guest today is Cedric De Leon. He has written an interesting new book called The Origins of Right to Work, subtitled Anti-Labor Democracy in 19th Century Chicago. And to the extent we can, I want to let the past inform the present and the future. Cedric, thanks for joining us today on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Cedric is an associate professor of sociology at Providence College, and you've chaired the department as well, right?
That's right. I'm the chair right now, actually.
Okay. And you have a labor past. Let's put it on the table here. You helped organize graduate students at your own alma mater at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also at Penn and the University of Illinois. Talk a little bit about your own connection to organized labor and why you think collective bargaining is important.
Well, working with the United Farm Workers in college was really my gateway drug into the movement. And right after college, my first job was as an organizer for District 1199, Service Employees International Union, here in Providence. And then from there, I, as you say, became active in the teachers union at the University of Michigan. And from there, I essentially was asked to help on several other campaigns to organize graduate students. And I think, you know, the connection between that past and the book is really that I was very active in the labor movement. And when I left it as an activist and staff person to become an academic, I thought that I left behind a labor movement that was quite strong and robust, embattled certainly by globalization, particularly in the manufacturing sector, but I thought quite strong. And when I found out that Michigan, the birthplace of the modern labor movement, and gone right to work in a lame duck session in 2011, I was absolutely gutted. And so the book is really an attempt to fight back, and in particular to show the violent history of right to work, because really, as I try to show, you know, right to work originates as a justification used by political elites to crush the labor movement by using violent force.
And it's all, you know, gilded with language of how this is to allow workers to compete, to set their own wages. It's about liberation and freedom, when in fact it is a not so cleverly disguised sequence of events that undermines union organizing. And it's fairly simple. It has to do with whether or not you permit an open or a closed shop. And an open shop means that you can come in to work with me, but you don't have to pay dues into my union. And that means that the collective bargaining, all of the negotiating that goes on to win us a new contract and maybe get a raise, I'm going to pay for it and you're not. And that, you know, fundamentally undermines the mechanics, the economics of organized labor. And it is a virus that has spread to now 26 states. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. West Virginia was the latest in a wave of states, beginning with Indiana and then moving on to Michigan and Wisconsin. And so now a majority of the states in the union are right to work. That's correct.
And let me just pull the curtain back a little bit. I've been a proud member of my union since the 1970s. It used to be called AFTRA. We merged with the Screen Actors Guild, and it was originally called the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, a white-collar union. But I served as a shop steward, a board member on the local level, and then I spent 11 years on the national board of our union, and we had a lot of issues with representing performers in right-to-work states. And it's very difficult to negotiate a good contract, and it's also hard to maintain the loyalty of your workforce in a bargaining unit. And so I'm pretty familiar with right to work for less, as most pro-labor people would describe it. And that is truly what it's about. It gives management more power. And in the kind of oligarchy that we live in today, it's frightening to see how much power is concentrated with capital. And so how little is now concentrated with the workforce.
Yes, that's right. And since the 1970s, you can track the growth of inequality along with the decline in union membership. They track almost perfectly together. So as union jobs get outsourced overseas, for example, beginning in the 1950s, but really accelerating in the 1970s, you see the gap between the rich and the poor growing ever wider, and we are the most unequal we have been since before the New Deal.
And Cedric, in your book, you trace the history of the rise of the right to work argument. And Chicago is where I cut my proverbial teeth. I worked at a union radio station. And let me just take a moment to describe the union rules at the time. This is in the 1970s. We had union announcers. That would be me. We had union members who ran the turntables, who were members of the American Federation of Musicians, and they had exclusive control over the turntables. And then we had NABET engineers. The people who turned the knobs and ran the transmitters were members of a technical union. And so it was the work rules were very explicit. I wasn't allowed to touch the turntable. I wasn't allowed to touch the control board or do anything of that sort, or I would draw a fine. There was one guy who kept a knife in his pocket, and you'd have to worry about drawing back, short a finger. But it all worked very effectively. And management didn't consider it a burden. It was a very efficient way to operate a business because the costs were quite predictable. Every 3 years when we negotiated a new contract, they could pencil out what it was going to cost to staff that radio station, you know, 24/7, and they knew what their costs were going to be. Now, they may have felt at a disadvantage competitively with non-union stations, but overall, it was a system that worked. But over years, we saw the radio industry change through deregulation, and operators who were clearly anti-union entered the fray. And I'm going into detail here because it's the industry that I know. But that's been replicated, as we saw just most recently in Sunday's New York Times, a powerful story about the shutdown of Hostess Brands in bankruptcy. And then these predatory hedge fund operators buy the brand, start baking Twinkies again, deliver it with non-union drivers. The workforce has been cut by over 70%. And these profiteers have paid themselves huge fees, loading up the new Twinkie company with massive debt in its first couple of years. And this formula certainly works for the top 1%. But they are decimating their consumer base. And this is one of the fundamentals that Henry Ford taught us, is you got to pay your assembly line worker enough so that he or she can afford to buy that car that's coming off the end of the line. And the moneyed interests in this country have lost sight of that, and Trump's plutocratic cabinet is just the latest indication.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I mean, I think it's all of a piece with right to work, or rather right to work is all of a piece with the rest of these trends that you mentioned, right? I mean, in some ways, you could argue that the right to work and deregulation and all the rest of it gives the individual the rights to do whatever they want, to pay or to not pay dues, to start a company or not to start a company, to have a union shop or to not have a union shop. But in the end, what ends up happening is that whereas the individual worker gains these sort of putative freedoms, the worker also at the same time as a class, as being part of a class, loses power, and society as a whole becomes more unequal. One way to do that is through right-to-work laws that essentially deprive workers' only organizations, only defense against the incursions of the boss, basically undermine those defenses with right-to-work laws. Another way to do it is to basically, you know, destroy a company, build it back again as non-union, and behave as if the union never existed. These are all different strategies to undermine the power of the working class, and in the end, it redounds to greater inequality in society as a whole.
And Cedric, it's pretty easy to target the capitalists. They make a huge and visible target. But at the same time, I think we have to be honest that organized labor and some of its leaders have helped hasten the decline of the influence of the labor movement in this country. What is your critique of the blunders that have been made by labor bosses in the last 10 or 15 years that may have given openings to those who wanted to expand right to work and reduce the representation of union members in the workforce?
Well, I think we're both right to lay most of the blame at the feet of capital. But to the degree that labor is responsible, it's in the fact that many unions are not particularly democratic organizations. They're not organizations that are especially run by the members themselves. I was a member of a union that was very member-run, very member-centered, less staff-driven, as they say. And that's exactly what the labor movement used to be, you know, in its heyday. And I think that labor bears some responsibility, because if the members had actually run some of the unions, right, that were in Wisconsin and Michigan and Indiana and all these other places where labor rights are under attack, then I think we might have seen a different picture. We might have seen more workers come out and defend their unions, because in point of fact, their unions are their own organizations. There are some unions, however, where, you know, they are not actually the organizations of the workers, of the members themselves. And so I think that is where trade unionists really bear the biggest responsibility, is in not maintaining, right, a democratic culture within their organizations, a grassroots social movement unionism. In many cases, it's become very top heavy, and the leadership is all that counts. And that's not what the labor movement needs to look like as we face Donald Trump and the forces of anti-labor conservatism.
And Cedric, what are your thoughts about the relationship between the top dogs at the AFL-CIO and the leaders of the Democratic Party? Because while the Democrats have paid lip service to the interests and the needs of organized labor, as we've seen during the Obama presidency, the guy who pledged to put on his comfy shoes and walk a picket line with rank-and-file members, the guy who promised card check, who promised that we were going to see, a rebalancing of the management-labor relationship through the National Labor Relations Board. None of this came to pass. And yet the AFL-CIO kept dumping money into Democratic campaigns and did so without getting a fair agreement on what they're going to get for the support and the shoe leather that they provided. And so we've seen organized labor diminish under a Democratic administration. And now with the ascendance of Trump and his he doesn't own Burger King. He owns Hardee's and Carl's Jr. This guy, right, Andrew Puzder, who's going, yeah, to be the Secretary of Labor. He's a member of what I call the Wrecking Crew. These are people, right, brought to Washington who are diametrically opposed to the mission of the agency that they're being appointed cabinet secretary to run. And so we saw that under an administration that at least paid lip service to labor, we got nothing. And now we have, you know, virulent opponents in policy-making positions. It's certainly not going to get better.
It's not. And the reason why all of this happened, Trump and all of the rest of the stuff that you talked about with the labor board and the failure of card check under the Obama administration, is a result, I think, of the fact that organized labor has been a captured constituency within the Democratic Party since about 1935. Right. And so the result is that labor has been largely ignored by the Democratic Party, because where else are we going to go? That's at least the assumption. That's what they tell us when we complain about the fact that we're not getting any pro-labor legislation through. And at the same time, we're unhoped for by the political establishment within the Republican Party, right? And so they feel free to basically hammer us with right-to-work laws, because they're not going to get any endorsements from us anyway. And so what you have with this election is a particular sector of the labor movement that more or less felt like they had been a forgotten constituency within the party system. And I think for actually good political reasons. I don't actually believe that they ought to have voted for Donald Trump, because I think they're going to get nothing. And actually, I think they're going to be attacked. But, you know, if you think about the Trump campaign, right, you think about what he said, that, you know, the white working class has been a forgotten people in this country, and you will not be forgotten anymore. You don't have a voice in Washington. I am your voice. He talked about trade deals. He talked about deindustrialization, the outsourcing of good union jobs overseas, and all of the rest of it. I mean, I think that the Democratic Party and the top leadership in the AFL bear a great deal of responsibility for not having, you know, put together a coherent agenda for an inclusive economic democracy that, you know, these folks who eventually defected to Donald Trump could actually understand, adhere to, and be loyal to.
Well, right? And Cedric, let's go back to the primary. Bernie Sanders had a very strong pro-worker message, and only the National Nurses United and I think the Postal Workers Union actually endorsed him. The big labor organizations stayed with Hillary Clinton and her lame message of incrementalism. Oh, I want to increase the minimum wage, but 15's too much. And oh, I'd love single-payer health care, but, you know, we're going to stick with Obamacare. And it was very clear, I'm sure you're aware, of the deep study the AFL-CIO did of labor members and non-union workers in the Cleveland area back in the spring. And it showed the strong support for Trump and the rejection of the Democratic Party labor nexus in so many respects. And Cedric, I'm one of the few lefties in media who actually predicted, regrettably, that Trump would win. And I bet my buddy Tom Frank $5 on August 2nd after he came on the show and he had been to both of the political conventions and he thought that Hillary was going to squeak it out. And I really felt, based on that labor study and my own anecdotal conversations with people in Michigan and Ohio this summer, that there was strong support for Trump that was not showing up in the polls and that was not recognized by the establishment leadership, the superdelegates of the Democratic Party.
Yes. Well, if you remember from the first debate, when Hillary Clinton was asked directly what she thought of NAFTA, instead of taking the correct pro-labor stance, instead of taking the stance that a party worthy of union endorsements would take, which was to be critical of trade deals that undercut the power of the working class, she actually said that on the whole, there were more jobs gained under NAFTA than were lost under NAFTA. And I think, you know, that is the classic kind of neoliberal, new age, DLC, Democratic line. And I think that organized labor has not gotten anything out of the partnership with the Democratic Party since, you know, the Wagner Act, since the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. All we have gotten from this partnership, all we have gotten from sticking with the Democratic Party through thick and thin, regardless of how much they disrespected us, was deindustrialization, globalization, deunionization, mass incarceration, and mass deportation. I think we need to do something different. And my view is that organized labor should continue to interact with the party system, but I think it ought to be politically independent. I think instead of being whipsawed and divided by the two-party system over race or trade, profession, and so forth, what we need to do is basically endorse pro-labor people regardless of party allegiance and move the entire party system to the left, towards labor. I think that is the only way forward. We've been doing the other thing for, you know, three generations now, and it hasn't worked.
Well, Cedric, that is an excellent critique, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I left the Democratic Party over 20 years ago. Not that I, you know, vote for Republicans very often, but I simply don't want to be taken for granted. I don't want to be wedged in on the Democratic Leadership Council bus that the Clintons have been forcing on us since 1992.
Yeah, well, that's a losing bus, okay? That's a bus on the way to Palookaville, right? Because look, you know, the only way that organized labor has been able to defeat right to work, okay, has been through forging a bipartisan coalition against right to work. If you think about the states that have beaten it back, Ohio in 2011, Missouri in 2014, Kentucky and Maine in 2015, they did that by basically telling the Republicans who represented white working class districts to put their money where their mouth is. You say you are the representative of the working class, fine. Prove it to us. Go and vote against right to work. And guess what? They voted against right to work. That is what I'm talking about. Now, by the way, I don't actually expect a ton of Republicans to get, you know, major labor endorsements, but it only takes a few in this very divided, highly polarized political situation in order to shift the balance of power. as we saw with a small number of defectors from the labor movement to the Trump campaign. Look, 54% of union households still stuck with Hillary Clinton, right? So they didn't require a huge defection, okay, to the Trump campaign to win, but that small defection was just enough, and look where we are now.
So, Cedric, going forward, and here I want to give you an opportunity to invoke the history that you explore in your book, The Origins of the Right to Work. Are we going to see, after another period of suffering and being in the wilderness, is there, in your view, a charismatic pro-labor candidate along the lines of Bernie Sanders who will surface in the next two or three cycles? Will we see a movement at the congressional level? Or do you think that rebuilding is required, starting at the local bargaining unit and really working from the grassroots upward?
I think we need to work from the grassroots upward. We played the game of trying to find a good, progressive, reliable, pro-labor Democrat for a long time. And either they get undercut because of, internal party shenanigans, as Bernie Sanders was, or they're co-opted or some other crazy thing that basically turns our dreams to dust. I think what we need to do is rebuild from the bottom up, get back to mass mobilization again, be a democratic social movement union that is able to exert upward pressure on the party system to represent us. Right. As what I think about is the story that some people tell about FDR back in 1936, when he and his staff were in the White House listening to the radio with bated breath, waiting for John L. Lewis's endorsement, because we didn't know whether the president of the mine workers, one of the most influential trade unionists of the time, was going to vote Democratic or Republican, right? And when he actually announced that he was going to endorse the Republican candidate, the biographers of FDR note a sort of hush in the room and everybody's faces fall, and they're just all so incredibly disappointed. That is where the labor movement needs to be. It needs to be coy, it needs to be politically independent, and it needs to be powerful, right? That's not going to come from cultivating and coaching a charismatic, democratic political elite to the presidency. I mean, we could do both, but without the grassroots pressure from below, we are going to go nowhere fast.
So, Cedric, are we gearing up for the next Haymarket riot? Is there going to be clashes on the streets with paid goons? G4S is the new Wacken Hut. And do you see any of this informed by the movements that occurred in recent years, the Occupy movement and the Black Lives Matter movements? Do you see any way that they could coalesce with workers to form a kind of new labor coalition?
Yes, I do see the opportunity. And I think, by the way, that the Haymarket massacres are not happening in clashes between bosses and workers. They're happening between police departments and black people, as well as white allies for racial justice. I mean, that's really where, you know, that particular fight is being played out. Now, with respect to the opportunity, look, I think that the labor movement cannot isolate itself from other movements for social justice, in part because folks who are involved in other movements are also potential trade unionists, right? I mean, if you think, for example, about the immigrant rights movement, right, and the ways in which, you know, there are some sectors of the workforce that are that have a high concentration of immigrant working class people, there are certainly overlapping interests there. There's no reason why the labor movement shouldn't be working very closely with immigrant rights groups. There's no reason why the labor movement ought not to be working with the Black Lives Matter movement. I think that we need to forge a broad coalition and say, for example, that if workers have the right to unionize, but unarmed black men are being shot dead in the street without any due process, without any reason at all. We do not live in a democracy. Or if black people are able to realize once again the dream of civil rights, but women are still being harassed in the workplace and they're still earning 70 cents on the dollar for the exact same job that a man does, we need to say that is not a democracy. If women have rights in the workplace and in the home, and we're still dragging gay people through the streets behind a pickup truck and murdering them, we do not live in a democracy. And what I think that does, right, painting that picture and embracing that inclusive vision of democracy is it brings different constituents of interest together. They don't have to love each other. They just have to know that they are in this coalition, okay, to realize a fuller, more inclusive vision of democracy. And if we're able to build that coalition, again, from the ground up, I think we could be a sight to see.
Cedric, that's a powerful description that you've offered. It conflicts with the mentality that is pervasive today that is based on threats to jobs. And so employers play the jobs card to keep union members and other employees in line. And since I mentioned jobs, you know, I'm out here near Silicon Valley, and St. Steve Jobs was running a syndicate to keep a lid on wages paid to engineers in Silicon Valley. And he set up his own little collusion gang with the leaders of Google and Pixar and a bunch of other tech companies. To its credit, Facebook was not a part of it. And they agreed not to poach each other's employees. It's just a new plantation mentality. And my point is that workers have been peeled off. And today, for example, organized labor does not have a consistent position about climate change because some of the unions, I have a lot of friends in the Electrical Workers Union, IBEW, but because they have contracts to run nuclear power plants for utilities and similar what I would consider conflicts of interest, they focus on the narrow interest of their members and their jobs, not on the community interest. And so labor has been guided by management and by threats of job loss into a much narrower perspective than we saw even 30 years ago when the head of the AFL-CIO would take a pretty strong position on social issues and bring the membership along with the leadership.
Well, I think this is actually a really important point that you're bringing up, the threat of jobs, and then conversely, the promise, right, of bringing the good union jobs back to the United States, which is the primary conceit of the Trump campaign, soon to be administration, right? I think that what we need to do is to once again offer an alternative vision for the rebuilding of a prosperous working class in this country. And what we need to do is to say these tens of millions of jobs that have been lost overseas, that actually capitalists have shipped overseas to fatten their bottom line, those jobs are not going to come back. But what we can do is make the crappy, low-wage, dead-end service sector jobs that are here and that cannot be moved, actually, to a developing nation because the janitorial work has to be done here. The floors are here. The mops and this, you know what I mean? Right, and the brooms are here, okay? To make those jobs the good union jobs of the future. You know, folks eulogize factory work, but anybody who's actually worked on an assembly line in a factory will tell you that factory work is horrible. It's mind-numbing, it's boring, and it destroys your soul, drives you to alcoholism and drug abuse. That just is true. But what workers did was organize, build their unions, and turn those crappy jobs into the good union jobs that they became. And I think that what we need to do is to say, listen, those jobs are not going to come back, but what we need to do in in collaboration or perhaps in pressuring political elites, is to basically take our gloves off, get card check, let workers be able to unionize again. Let's allow workers who, if their majority of them in a workplace agreed to join a union, then that's a union workplace. And now the boss needs to sit down and bargain a contract with them. That is the only way to rebuild the working class in this country again, right? And so, you know, I think part of the reason that we are able to be divided by bosses who, you know, who threaten us with job loss and so forth is because the labor movement doesn't have a coherent agenda of its own, okay, to make an economic democracy out of, you know, this service sector workforce that we have. Were we to actually say that this was front and center on our agenda, that this is what we wanted to do, that this was our vision, then we would be able to undercut all of these strategies that are used by bosses to pick us off one by one.
And Cedric, in the epilogue to your book, you describe the recent setbacks, the right-to-work legislation in Michigan and Indiana, the attempts to curtail collective bargaining by public employees in Wisconsin and in Ohio. And you identify an important element, because as labor retrenches, seniority is a driver in who gets to keep working. And mm-hmm. this pushes out, particularly in the private sector, minorities and people of color, because the baby boomers who still have a union job in a manufacturing or industrial facility have the seniority to hold on, where you know, younger people and those who were brought in under affirmative action over the last 30 years, they're vulnerable. And so at a time when we could see an expansion beyond the white working class to enjoy middle class employment, we're actually mm-hmm. seeing it contract. And I don't see labor addressing the needs of people of color who are being left behind by the retrenchment of organized labor.
Well, see, Peter, this is where the good union jobs of the future agenda, right, is the solution. Right. And what I mean by that is, who is it who occupies these low wage service sector jobs? Right. They're women. People of color are disproportionately represented in these particular jobs. And so I think that in unionizing these folks and these particular sectors of the economy, we address some of the gender and racial disparity that really has been a contradiction within the labor movement since the New Deal. As you know, as historians, lay historians and professional historians of labor know, you know, there were certain folks who were cut out of the National Labor Relations Act, which gave American workers the freedom to bargain for the first time. And those were agricultural workers and domestic workers. And of course, you know, this deal was cut to keep women and people of color out of the labor movement. Some say as a compromise with the Dixiecrat South. Some say because they needed to get the approval of farming states in the West and in California. But whatever way you cut it, women and people of color have been shut out of the labor movement historically. Getting back to good union jobs, turning service sector jobs into the good union jobs of the future will begin to address that gender and racial contradiction within the labor movement and make the labor movement more inclusive.
In your book, The Origins of Right to Work, you say, Though people of color technically have legal access to these programs, you're talking about social programs, the welfare yes. state is dramatically diminished overall, and to the degree that it persists, its programs primarily serve the white middle class. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the poorest one-fifth of American households consumed 54% of social benefits in 1979. Today, that is down to 36%. While the lion's share goes toward maintaining the middle class from childhood through retirement. Meanwhile, social welfare for the poorest citizens, among whom people of color are disproportionately represented, has largely been dismantled. And so against that backdrop, with a contracting safety net, with restricted opportunity, and with increased efforts to demonize and diminish the influence of organized labor, workers in this country are in for a tough slog for the foreseeable future, would you say?
We are in it for a tough slog. But look, you know, here's the thing, right? As I show in my book, right, workers have faced firing squads. You know, in the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, 20,000 men were under arms to basically crush the labor movement in Chicago. These were folks from the U.S. Armed Forces, local police, and private militia. Okay, that was a very scary time to be a trade unionist. Okay, you were shot in the streets for being with the union. And, you know, Trump is sort of like a fuzzy warm uncle compared to those times, right? I mean, my point is this, Peter.
Well, let me interrupt you on the fuzzy warm uncle, okay? Because there are Polish workers who were brought in to demolish the Bonwit Teller building to make way for one of Trump's hotels in New York, who were paid $4 an hour. We're not given gloves working in winter. We're not given protection from asbestos that they were removing from this ancient building. And when he was done with them, he disposed of them and shipped them back to Poland. I can't accept any kind of normalization of Trump because he's ruthless when it comes to workers. And this hotel that he's built in the post office that he leased down the street from the White House was built with some undocumented immigrant labor. And so I can't accept that fuzzy uncle thing. Sorry.
No, he's not. I'm using a little rhetorical trick there, perhaps inappropriate. My point, however, is that we faced far worse than Donald Trump. And if we can beat those bosses back in the Gilded Age who had no compunction at all, about shooting a worker, in the streets, then we can face down this guy. What we need to be able to do is agree upon a loose agenda, but a coherent agenda for truly inclusive economic democracy. We can do that. We organize for a living. That is what the labor movement does, right? And I think that if we can just get on the same page, we don't have to agree on everything. But three or four principles to build a movement around, to first of all, unify the existing labor movement, which remains, by the way, the largest labor movement in the entire world. Okay. If we can unify the existing labor movement and then build out, right, with this message of economic democracy, I think we can not only hold the line against Donald Trump, which I think we're going to have to do, at least in the near term, as we build this movement, but I think ultimately we'll be able to defeat him.
Cedric, it's a real pleasure to meet you. Thanks for joining me here today. His book is The Origins of Right to Work, Anti-Labor Democracy in 19th Century Chicago. Cedric De Leon, an associate professor of sociology at Providence College. Real pleasure to talk with you today.
Likewise, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Cedric De Leon. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep keep smiling and